Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Women of the Word podcast. Jen, thanks again for joining me today.
Good to be back.
Yes. So like I mentioned at the end of the last episode, this week we're going to be talking about names and numbers in the Bible. Now, I'm not a numbers girly, but names are something I think we're all aware of. We can relate to those, understand their significance. Mm-hmm. First of all, because we all have a name, but also because they're things we give to our children. It's how we identify people. It's just easy to understand their significance even now. So I know, Jen, that you've told this story in other places, but how significant was your name when you were born?
Well, apparently my name was very insignificant from the standpoint that it was the most popular name for girls in the United States, and I mean in all 50 states, from 1970 to 1984. So over a 14-year period, the number one name to name your child was Jennifer if you had a girl. So I, you know, you can throw a rock and hit a Jennifer even to this day. Yeah. And I always grew up with a bunch of different nicknames because there were so many of us in any given class. And so, yeah, my name is not very special. And in fact, I didn't even know that my name had a particular meaning until I was well into adulthood. It had really not even occurred to me that that names had meanings beyond like that you might have been named for someone in your family or something like that.
Yeah. Or like your mom just liked it or something.
You know, and the funny thing is, I asked my mom, I said, why did you give me such a common name? And she said, oh, I didn't know anybody else who had named their daughter Jennifer. So I guess my mom didn't get out much. Do you know what your name means?
It's like Lauren, I think, means queen of laurel leaves or something like that.
I like that you were able to work queen into the meaning of yours. Yeah, that feels good.
I mean, that's just what the meaning is. Yeah. I'm not adding that to myself. Yeah.
Okay. But. Jennifer means crest of the white wave, which I think is also sort of like an authoritative position there too, right?
I agree. So, that's really
beautiful. Both you and that's nice. Clearly named to rule things.
Exactly. When I was born, my name was also, I looked it up before this, was also like, height of popularity, but not nearly to the extent that your name was.
Lots of Laurens, lots of Mackenzies. I'm trying to think about your generation. Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Megans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, names significant, maybe less significant in some ways whenever 50 million people have the same one. Uh-huh. But in the Bible, they are significant and have specific meaning, as do numbers.
Yes.
So before we dive into the nitty-gritty details when it comes to names and numbers in the Bible, maybe, Jen, you can help us orient ourselves around this issue. So how does understanding names and numbers in the Bible impact the way we read it?
Well, for one thing, I think it invites us into that original audience's space. And so when you think about the way that the original hearers of the writings of Moses would have received his writings, so let's just go with the first five books of the Bible, they would not have had a physical copy to hold on to. And so having names that are memorable, that have a meaning associated with them, versus just having a name maybe that was made up or that didn't have any particular recognizable meaning, is another way for a listener to be able to remember what they're hearing. And the same thing is true with numbers. Numbers, as we're going to talk about, are often used in symbolic ways. And so when we understand the purpose behind it, it helps us to think, oh, this is actually a way that an ancient Near Eastern mind would have thought when they were reading this. Like, we read a number like that there were 12 generations between this person and this person, and we're like, oh, it's exactly 12, because that's the way that we think in our modern context. But in the ancient Near East, they were not so concerned with whether it was actually 12. They were more concerned with hearing, oh, 12. I know what that means. 12 is a number that means something bigger than the number 12 itself. So it might have been 12, or it might have just been a number that was communicating an idea that was sticky that they could then remember when they were months or years out from having heard something read. So I think they're important because they are, and that is not to say that the names and numbers that we find in the Bible are not the actual names and numbers. It's to say that the ancient Near Eastern mind was not overly concerned with that part of the reading. They were more concerned with the flow of the story, with what a character was contributing to the story, or a number was contributing to the story in their understanding of God.
Yeah, great. That's super helpful. We'll keep that in mind as the big picture as we kind of break this down a little bit more in detail. Mm-hmm. So let's start with names. Why are names in the Bible significant?
Well, you know, it depends on the name. And I think that sometimes something some of us have missed when we're reading in our copy of the Bible is that in most cases, there is a footnote next to an Old Testament name that tells us the general sense of what the name meant. So the word Abram means father of many. The word Abraham means father of a multitude. And so when you know the trajectory of Abraham's story and the children that come from Abraham and Sarah, the whole nation of Israel, which when you follow that through the end of the to the end of the Bible, we see that that's a multitude. Then we know that his name was prophetic in a sense. But we also know it was just his name. That's what people called him. You think about the story of Rachel and Leah that we find in Jacob's life story. And actually all of the names in those stories of the patriarchs in Genesis in particular are meant to help our memories and also help our understanding. So you've got Jacob, whose name means grasps the heel, which is sort of a way of saying that he is deceptive. And then we find that it actually illustrates his character. His name illustrates his character. Then we get to the story of his wives and Rachel. Her name means ewe lamb. So this beautiful, sweet image. And Leah's name means wild cow. And so you're meant to see, oh, one of these is one he would be, you know, really thrilled to be married to. And another is kind of like, what? And again, these are names you would expect that a herdsman like Laban would name his daughters. They're not shocking names, but they're names that are telling more than just the name of the character. They're telling us something about how the cues as to how the story is going to play out. You think about Israel, the name that is given to Jacob to replace the name of the usurper, or the one who grasps or deceives. And Israel is sort of an unclear name meaning. It means he contends. In other words, he wrestles, he struggles. And it's unclear whether the reference is to Jacob wrestling with God and with his role in redemptive history, or if it's God contending for Jacob on his behalf. And so we read that name meaning and we think, actually, I don't think I have to choose between the two. I think it might be intentionally unclear so that we know both ideas are being represented in the story of the renaming of Jacob to Israel.
Yeah, that's really helpful. As we're reading the Bible, both Old Testament, New Testament, we come across a lot of names, though. And so the ones in the examples that you gave are very clear. We can remember those stories. We know that name has significance based on then what we read about their life and about their story from the Old Testament. As we're reading in other places where maybe that's not as clear, or the story doesn't necessarily go with the name as easily as Jacob's does, for example, how can we know which names actually truly are significant?
Well, I think it's good to pay attention to where else those names show up. You know, so like if there are names that show up in a genealogy, then we probably want to pay more attention to them than if they're names that you only hear one time. Sometimes a name is given one time because it might have had a significance to the original audience that isn't essential to us to understand what's going on. But a name like Jezebel, for example, Jezebel is in the Old Testament. She is a literal person, but she also represents an entire idea. And we see her name repeated, for example, in the book of Revelation. And so we pay attention to it where we find it in the Old Testament because it's going to play into our understanding of something in the New Testament. It is good to remember, though, that when we come to the New Testament and we're seeing people's names, that a lot of what we're seeing is both their Hebrew name and their Greek name that are given. So the, probably the best example of this is you'll hear people talk about how God renames Saul and gives him the name Paul. But that's not actually what the New Testament shows us. He's referred to as both because he's referred to by his Greek name and his Hebrew name. Saul is his Hebrew name, and then when he becomes an apostle to the Gentiles, we start to hear him referred to by his Greek name, Paul. And there are other examples of this. So sometimes we see Peter just referred to as Simon. Sometimes we hear him referred to as Simon Peter, and sometimes we hear him just referred to as Peter. So almost keeping a cast of characters. And I know when I use the term characters, it can sound like I'm treating the whole Bible like fiction. I don't mean that. But to keep sort of a running list of who's who as you're reading through the New Testament or through the Old Testament can be really helpful. So yeah, we have those examples of New Testament names that might, there might be more than one name for a person. It might be their Hebrew and Greek, or it might just be that there are two ways that they're spoken of. But in the Old Testament, it is more common to see people who have names that have some dual significance.
Jen, can you speak a little bit to the significance of when God renames someone in the Bible?
Yeah.
What significance does that have? And should we always make sure to pay attention when someone is renamed?
Oh, yeah. I think we should always perk up our ears. It usually reflects, because so often Old Testament names are a reflection of a person's character. And it usually signifies some shift either in their role or in their character in the text. So we mentioned Jacob, who goes from being characterized as the deceiver to being characterized as the one with whom God contends, or the one who contends with God. And I think either way that you understand that is good. Mm-hmm. Both ways are important to our understanding. But before that, we saw that renaming, which I mentioned in passing, where Abram goes from being the father of many to being Abraham, father of a multitude. And that's a prophetic statement about what his role will be in the family of God. Similarly, Sarai is renamed Sarah, which gives her a princess-like title, meaning that obviously she's going to be the mother of the multitude that's going to come through her, which was an important detail to the story because there was a period of time in which the two of them believed that the righteous line could come through Hagar. And was not to be. They had already received a promise in their renaming that was significant. So, yeah. And then there are also times in the Old Testament where, similar to what we see in the New Testament, we're seeing a name that is given when an Israelite is taken captive to Babylon, mm-hmm. or is a part of another culture. And so they have both that name and their Hebrew name. So an example of this would be how Daniel has the name Belshazzar when he is in Babylonian captivity.
Yeah. So a different name, but not necessarily God-given change.
Right. If anything, the way that name is used in the narrative is to help us feel the sense of his distance from his place of belonging and his isolation in that culture. Yeah.
Yeah. So both significant, whether it's mm-hmm. a cultural name change or something that is God-given. Either way, that is a significant detail that we should be mindful of because it's trying to communicate something about theme, their purpose, or even their circumstance mm-hmm. to us in a way that they didn't have to necessarily draw out specifically. Mm-hmm. The name change communicates that.
And, one other thing we can think about, I'm thinking specifically of the example of Jacob, although it's not the only place, is that when we understand his name meaning, it helps us better to interpret his actions. Mm. So when we understand, there's the silence of the narrator in those Old Testament histories so often, to where we as modern listeners are thinking, wait, a terrible thing just happened. Is anybody else paying attention to this? Or maybe since something wasn't said explicitly that this is a terrible thing, I'm supposed to think it's not terrible. So an example would be when Jacob is deceiving his father into giving him the birthright. But when we understand that he's been characterized as a deceiver, then we are better able to interpret what's happening in the passage as, oh, no, this is wrong. That's been something that's associated with his name. Another example might be in Genesis, one of my favorite name meanings that I didn't have clarity around for years and now learned a really great thing about, was that the name Cain is the essence of the meaning of that name is it's an exclamation of here he is. It's Eve basically believing that God has delivered the one who will crush the head of the serpent in her firstborn child. And so when we understand that that's what that name is communicating, then we understand with greater depth the irony and pain of him turning out to be actually the first taker of life. He's the first one to slay someone made in the image of God.
Yeah, wow. That's really helpful. Let's now transition to talking about numbers. Why are numbers in the Bible significant?
Well, again, we're looking for memory hooks, right? We're looking for ways for people to remember large concepts if they maybe are going to live their entire lives without ever holding a physical copy of a Bible. So I think when we talk about this discussion about numbers, it is good for us to remember the riches that we have in our current day and age, that we do have not just physical copies, but access to digital copies. We can access the Bible in a matter of seconds as long as we have our phones on us. And that just wasn't the common experience for people throughout history. So that means that in order to, as I mentioned earlier, get into sort of the original skin of those people to whom the texts were given originally, we have to think differently than we might. And we live in a day where we're empiricists. We like the exact measurement for the exact thing. And this is also an idea that is not really compatible with the ancient Near Eastern mind. I've often reflected that we don't give God enough credit for being a poet. And so we are uncomfortable with the idea that a number might not be an actual number, because that is not our modern understanding of how numbers function. But that would not have been the case with those to whom the Bible was originally written. So we owe it to them to say, well, how did you hear this, so that we can hear it in a similar way? So you think about the way that numbers are first used. So think about, you know, where they show up in the book of Genesis, because if we have an understanding of how numbers are given to us, even in those opening lines of the Bible, at the very beginning, then we're able to trace that through all the way through the scriptures. So several numbers become significant. The creation account is built around seven, the number seven. Most people know that. But when you think about the things that are created on particular days, it helps us to understand how numbers with that are underneath that number seven are used elsewhere in scripture. So the number two is a significant number throughout the Bible because it's the number of a faithful witness, where two or three are gathered in my name. And you can trace that number two in terms of two witnesses all the way from our original two witnesses to the goodness and trustworthiness of God, Adam and Eve, all the way through the Bible to where Jesus sends out his disciples two by two. I'm skipping over a lot of other twos as I say this, but all the way to the book of Revelation, where we see that there are two witnesses to the law and the prophets who are bearing testimony to the fulfillment of those in Christ. And so the two witnesses theme, that number two, is introduced to us in the creation account. Similarly, the number four, if you look at the fourth day of creation, it's the day that the created order is complete and ready to begin to be filled and populated. And so when we look at the way that the number four is used in the rest of the Bible, it is in fact tied to the created order. Things like the four winds or the four corners of the earth, those are references to that creation day. The number six, the sixth day of creation, the day in which humankind is created, it's significant that we see the number six attached to human governments, to human plans, to anything that is less than holy. You think about the number 666 in the book of Revelation, which is affirming that the one who bears it is nothing more than a created being, not God, not holy, 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 which brings us to the number seven, which is the number of completeness, divine completeness. And so in the same way that we see 666 in Revelation to represent the limitedness of human rule and human kingdoms, we see the number seven in holy, 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 that God is 777. He is perfect and complete. Those are just a handful of examples, but you see sevenfold praise offered to God in the Psalms. You see it in Revelation as well. You see all kinds of sevenfold patterns that are meant to indicate that God is perfect and holy. So the biblical authors are playing with these numbers, obviously under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, to help us to have ways to remember bigger stories that are happening in the flow of the text.
Yeah. A couple follow-up questions based on some of the things you said. So some of the examples you used were because this number in the days of creation mm-hmm. represented this theme, mm-hmm. when we see that number in other places in scripture, we should kind of apply the similar type of meaning that it had on the creation in the creation story to that instance of that number.
Yeah.
Is that how we should think about all numbers? If we see repeated numbers, they carry the same significance every time they're used? Or would there be circumstances where, like, just because they use that number here does not mean that it's connected to this use of this number in that circumstance?
Well, I would say if a number is one of those creation numbers or is a multiple, yeah. you know, you get into the multiples thing too. So anytime, so if two is the number of witness and six is the number of humanity, well, two times six is 12. And that number 12 obviously figures significantly into the biblical text. And the number 12 is often referred to as the number of God's people. It is a double human witness is one way that it's sometimes said, the six times yeah. two. And so you see the number 12 in the 12 tribes of Israel. You see it in the 12 apostles. You see it multiplied 12 times 12 times 1,000 to be 144,000 in places. Hmm. And anytime you see these, because 10 is another number of completeness. And yeah. So when we see the way that those numbers are being used, then we begin to recognize, oh, I think there's that. While it may be important to say, oh, there are 144,000, that it's more important to say, oh, this is meant to show us the complete number of the people of God. That's a more important idea than whether it is exactly 144,000. Or even in the genealogies that we find in the Old Testament, sometimes there are exactly 70 names in a genealogy. Well, that's an awfully convenient number of names. The ancient Near Eastern mind was not as concerned with cataloging every single person who goes into Israel. They were more concerned with demonstrating that 7 times 10 people from the family of Jacob went into Israel, that the complete and perfect number, and we even get that divine sovereign hand piece, you know, laid into the number 70. Similarly, if you look at the life of Moses, it's divided into increments of 40 years. Well, 40 years is a generation in the understanding of the ancient Near Eastern mind. So his life is parsed out for us that when he is when one generation has passed, this happens in his life. When another generation has come to pass, this happens in his life. Israel is going to wander in the desert for another 40-year increment of Moses' life. So again, is it important to say Moses was 80 years old when such and such happened? Well, it's not unimportant. It's just more important to recognize that the story is being told in a way that we will remember and understand the significance of, oh my goodness, generations are passing while God's faithfulness is coming to play at just the right time through his servant Moses.
Yeah, helpful. Is that kind of what you meant whenever at the beginning you said sometimes in the Bible a number is not a number?
Yes.
Where the number is a number, but it might not be the tried and true exact one.
Right. So we're concerned, yeah. We are concerned with factual accuracy as modern hearers. And yeah. It's not, and again, I'm not taking away from the factual aspects of these stories. I'm saying that the way that factual information was communicated in the ancient Near East was less dependent on giving us an exact number and more dependent on giving us an exact representation of the significant ideas that were playing out in a story.
Yeah, super, super helpful. So it sounds like what we're talking about right now is a literal versus figurative use of numbers in the Bible. Is that correct?
That's right. And so, you know, this is why I think people's temperatures can rise around these conversations is because we have been told we're supposed to take the Bible literally. And so when we come to numbers and we see a number that might not be used in a literal way, in the way that we understand a literal reading, we start to think, wait a minute, if I can't trust that this number is a literal number, then can I trust anything in the Bible? How do I even know? And I actually think that it's a valid first response based on the fact that we're all creatures of our own day and age. But if we take a minute to settle in and go, well, wait a minute, what's being lost here? I mean, there's really not anything necessarily being lost by understanding this number in a figurative way. It doesn't mean that nothing in the Bible is to be taken literally. It just means that not everything in the Bible is to be read in a woodenly literal manner. And so it's often been reflected that in our day and age, our first impulse is to look for what's literal and our second impulse is to look for what is figurative, but that the ancient Near Eastern mind was doing the opposite. They were looking first for what is figurative and second had a concern about what was a literal understanding. So I think numbers is a good place where we see that as an example. However, when we come to things like, because this is where the conversation always goes, the resurrection of Christ. Well, am I supposed to only understand that figuratively? Well, you know, as we'll talk about when we talk about genres, no, you're supposed to understand that literally. I mean, that's the way that that particular form of writing is given to us. It's telling us something that actually happened. So yeah, I think that as people who are wanting to be better readers of the Bible, we have to ask, how were these tools understood by the ancient audience? We shouldn't read them the way that a modern person would read them if that's not the way that an ancient person would ever have read them.
Yeah, I think maybe something good to talk through now is knowing that there are numbers in the Bible that are used figuratively and not always literally. Mm-hmm. What are helpful tools for people as they're reading to be able to deduce that for themselves, which numbers that can be taken literally versus which are figurative?
Mm-hmm. I think it's good to have just a running hit list of the most typical numbers that you're going to see repeated. and to just pay attention to those, because those are being dropped in there in all likelihood on purpose to help you remember or connect. So that's going to be, the short list would be 2, 3, 6, 7, 12, any multiple of 12, 10. Those will take you a long way. Those will take you a long way to being able to think, okay, well, I understand the symbolic application of this number. And then I can figure out what the literal takeaway is that I need to from this. But understanding that symbolic piece is equally, if not more important, depending on what portion of the Bible that you're in. I do just want to add one caveat, and that is that people can get so wrapped up in these numbers that they can miss the whole, they can feel like the numbers are like a secret decoder ring kind of effect. Or my least favorite is when they begin to think the numbers are in some way magical. And so these numbers are not, they don't hold some special power other than that they're memory tools. They're given to us as memory tools. And so they're not mystical. They're very practical. And so, you know, you can find books out there that are written on like the number codes in the Bible. It's like, no, if it requires a whole lot of, quote, special knowledge to understand how these numbers are being used, then we should have red flags around it. But if it's just lying there for everyone to see, where if you know there are 7 days in the creation account, and that was at the beginning, so you should expect to see that all the way through, well, that's not hard to find. It's just that many of us have not been encouraged to do so. But it's the assumption of the ancient Near Eastern author and audience that numbers would be used with deliberation.
Yeah, that's a helpful distinction to clarify. Maybe as we wrap up here, we can kind of take that one step further. So what impact does understanding the significance of names and numbers in the Bible have on our study of the Bible? Why is it helpful to keep in mind their significance and not just gloss over them as purely details that is in the text?
Yeah, when we begin to familiarize ourselves with the way that names and numbers are used, we have a very important interpretive tool at our fingertips. When we understand that the numbers are communicating something interpretative to us and that the names are, then it means that when we set about the work of moving from what does it say to what does it mean, that we're going to keep those touch points in view. So kind of like the example that I gave earlier, we're going to think about the significance of Jacob's name as it relates to the way that his story is told. We're going to think about the significance that he has 12 sons differently than we would if we didn't understand that the number 12 signified the people of God. And so it just means that instead of being like, wow, he had a lot of kids, we're able to say, look at God's divine hand in the story of Jacob and his offspring and how he is doing exactly what he said he would do to the one that he named the father of a multitude. And his people are going to be perfect and complete, and they are all numbered by him, and they will come to pass just as he has said.
Yes, so helpful. Jen, thanks again for helping us think through this topic. I'm grateful that even through these conversations, I'm reminded that every detail in the Bible is purposeful and important, even the seemingly small things like names and numbers. So make sure to join us again next week, where we're going to discuss word studies, what they are, how to do them correctly, and how they fit into our overall study of the Bible. So thanks, Jen.